and welcome. We have a couple of questions to dive into while we're waiting for any additional questions to be submitted here. So I'm going to share screen here. And hope you're having a beautiful summer, everyone, as we transition into fall here. Okay, so here we have a question. This is a question about a female who's 50 years old. Brand new client, just had a breast cancer diagnosis recently and surgery 1 month ago. It is invasive lobular carcinoma. It is estrogen and progesterone positive, scoring very high for that, so largely hormone driven. It is negative for the HER2 protein. The surgery went well and everything was removed with no spreading to the lymph. She will have radiation therapy and will take a daily anti-hormone tablet, tamoxifen. I don't have any labs right now. My plan is to go low carb with high fat with diet and plenty of good organic low carb veggies. Moderate organic proteins, good fats, and cruciferous veggies. Not quite keto because I don't think she will manage to comply. Plus, I haven't, at first glance in my research, seen it mentioned as the main diet for breast cancer. I will emphasize how to reduce toxins because I think she doesn't use natural products or think about this issue at all. I will also get her to fast 13 hours overnight as I read a study that this can reduce breast cancer recurrence. Also some intermittent fasting a couple of times a week, but she is already very thin, borderline underweight, can't fast too much. Then we'll look specifically at supporting the detox function and look for gut issues. She doesn't have any specific GI symptoms as the following steps. Is there anything that we would change or add to that plan? Thanks. P.S. Thought about doing Dutch test to see reproductive hormones, but think she has already started tamoxifen and don't know if this test would be relevant if she's on tamoxifen. Breast cancer also has HSV1 virus as of 13 years ago. Suspected body-mind relationship, environmental root causes. She doesn't like her job nor her boss. Thinks she gets depressed, may feel isolated. Seems to be very concerned about what other people need and doesn't put herself first with her job and boss, for example. So before I go on here, I'm going to give a couple side notes. So one side note is that with cancer especially, there's quite a bit of emotional involvement and autoimmune disease as well. There's some practitioners who really are trying to map this out and trying to map out what specific emotional patterns are associated with which autoimmune diseases and cancers. That's not clearly mapped out yet, but we have to consider stress. We have to consider mental emotional turmoil, and we have to consider the stigma around the diagnosis of cancer and how other people in a person's life are going to be treating that person differently after diagnosis. So one of the big mindfulness pieces here that I just want to bring up right away is that dialoguing a little bit about the diagnosis and about how people treat someone who has cancer and about a person's internal attitude and resilience in the face of how they're being treated by others is a worthwhile exploration. And because we know that when someone gets that cancer diagnosis, it's a big mindset shift for that person. They start to think about death. They start to think about people passing, family members passing, other people in their lives who have passed from cancer. Cancer is one of the three big killers. So we have, you know, cardiovascular disease being number one, cancers really come in at number two, and then neurodegenerative diseases are the other big class, Alzheimer's, dementia. And whenever we're dealing with something where there's a diagnosis and then often a progression followed by passing away, we have to really consider that there's going to be a lot of weight, mental, emotional weight to that diagnosis. And we have to think about how to approach that and dialogue about that while we're also dealing with the physiological side of working through some of the lab testing. And the truth of the matter is not a lot changes in terms of lab testing and what we do. There are a few nuanced things, but root cause is root cause. And cancer, just like other chronic illnesses, have toxic, they have gut components, they have toxic burden components, they have chronic infection components, they may have nutrient imbalances and diet imbalances, they may have environmental exposures, habits are going to be important, the, you know, chemicals that people are exposed to are going to be important. But that's not unique to cancer, that's unique to chronic disease in general. And chronic disease in general is a wide ranging thing, especially with the CDC now coming out and saying 6 in 10 people have at least one chronic disease. That's 60%, that's majority. So root causes are going to be similar. There will be some nuanced tweaks, and we'll get into those. And dialogue about the diagnosis is one of those unique things that are, it's important to do for all chronic disease, but especially important with cancer. So there's going to be a few things to dialogue around the label, the social interpersonal impacts of that label, the personal impacts of that label, the mindset that a person has around that label, and whether the person has a solid stress resilience practices and a set of stress resilience practices and ways to work with their own thought patterns, emotions, and attitudes. Do they have meditation practices? Do they have ways to witness their own thought patterns and allow them to be as they are without trying to change them, but also not getting lost in them? And that's going to be extremely important. Another side comment before we go on is, here we have a situation where it's a hormone dominant cancer, and there was a thought about doing a Dutch test, but not sure if it's valid with tamoxifen. And Dutch certainly wouldn't be the first go-to test that I would be thinking in this case. There's plenty of other tests that I would prioritize a little higher in this case, because really I'm wanting to assess for, you know, first off, we're going to, for legal reasons alone, want to not be touching hormones too much. And secondly, we're going to really want to have a sense for inflammatory burden, toxic burden, and gut impacts as our primary root cause issues that we're looking to address here. So I agree with you. I think, you know, it's not going to be so relevant in this case. I think if we can get some blood markers, if we can get some markers that are looking at inflammatory effects in the body, inflammatory markers, we may be thinking about a NAGLase in this case to help track progress as one marker of progress, depending on how often she's getting scans and other markers of progress to know how what we're doing is impacting or not impacting. So that would be another test to consider. And then gut testing for sure would be important to consider, and toxic burden testing and or chronic infection testing like Lyme and co-infections. For toxic burden, we may look at metals, we may look at mycotoxin, either urine testing or blood testing for inflammatory markers associated with mycotoxin like HLA-DR and TGF-beta-1. So those would be the testing considerations that I'd really like to make in this case. So breast cancer also has HSV-1 virus as of 13 years ago. Does not like her job and her boss, gets depressed, may feel isolated. So, you know, we're already seeing mental, emotional stuff on top of the diagnosis. So that's going to be important. Non-serving diet, possibly not enough self-care, boundaries. How does stress play a role? Well, stressful job, travel quite a bit. And are there mental, emotional, spiritual dynamics? Don't know more at this stage. And then also has diagnosis of Raynaud's for 10 years and recent joint pain. So joint pain, again, is potentially linked with gut issues or toxic burden or chronic infection. So again, we're pointing in those three primary directions in this case. And we had a follow-up about this same case. So an additional comment is that that first session happened and it turned out she had been living in a moldy apartment for the past 8 years and is still there. She had a chronic cough for 4 years and knows she reacts to mold. Can we comment on how mold may have contributed to the cancer if it has? And do we see a link between the two issues of breast cancer and mold? She will be finally moving out at the end of September. It is interesting that she hasn't moved out before, even though she knew the situation was damaging to her health somehow. So that tells us something about the psychology of this case. Thought it would be good to have the whole picture for when we're doing the discussion. Okay, so we're going to switch over to a whiteboard here so that we can talk a little bit about this case, discuss it, and write some things down. So basically, you know, the big points are this is a breast cancer case that we're looking at. And of course, it's a person who's struggling with this issue, and we need to look at the whole person. So that's important. We also, another important piece is that we had mold exposure. That's really going to be critical in what we're going to look at and evaluate for. And we also have some mental, emotional stuff in the background that we're having to navigate around and look at when we're dealing with this case. And then we're going to really want to put together a plan. I mean, you know, this is someone who's 40 years old with this diagnosis, and this is going to be significant. One important point to note is hormone sensitive, because that's going to impact treatment and what we can do and not do. So these are all going to be important points. So we want to look at the, you know, testing recommendations. And in terms of testing recommendations, we already talked a little bit, but we're going to say that, you know, HLA, DR, mold genetic testing is going to be really important in this case. And this is LabCorp 167120 is the code for that particular test. If you're not going through insurance and you are able to have an account with professional co-op, that's a way to go. If you aren't, then you can also look at a panel through Life Extension, and you may be able to get an account with them and do a panel through them. Then you're going to look at TGF beta 1, that's transcription growth factor beta 1, also through LabCorp, and that's going to be an important one as well to assess for the inflammation related to mold. We may want to NAGLase, I'm going to put a question mark, if we want a blood marker to track progress. For those who don't know much about NAGLase, NAGLase is an enzyme that becomes elevated when people have either chronic viral infection or cancer. Cancer cells and viruses can release this enzyme. It's an enzyme that combats the macrophage activity in the body, and so it impacts the immune system, and it's a survival mechanism for things like cancer. So it can be a reasonable marker to track our progress when we're dealing with someone with cancer. That would be through Health Diagnostics Research Institute. Then we want some blood markers, and this is especially, we're especially going to want inflammatory markers, and these are going to be things like HSCRP, homocysteine. We're probably going to want to see some inflammatory markers if we could, like TNF-alpha. I'm going to put a question mark because we're not always easily able to get that. But if we are, then that can be a great one to have. And we may want to see something like an LP, PLA-C. This is more cardiovascular related, but it is an inflammatory marker, and it's going to give us a general sense. If we could get some oxidative markers, that might be helpful. So we could do something like an organics or Nutrival. Nutrival or organics are going to look at some of the nutrient markers. They're going to look at some things related to detoxification and toxic burden. They're going to look at some neurotransmitter markers, which may relate to the mental emotional piece. And that could be useful in this case as well. Actually, I'm going to go way back up here, and I'm going to put SIBO and or comprehensive stool. And that's important because that's going to be a marker that's potentially going to be helpful for really assessing if there are gut-related impacts, because we're going to see, of course, toxin issues get worse when there are gut issues, and we're going to see the immune system be compromised when there are gut issues. So gut's going to be a big area of focus. Then that's tier one. In tier two, we're going to have Lyme and co-infections here. I'm not putting that quite as high a priority because we already know there's mold exposure in this case, and we want to look at that plus gut first, together with the blood markers where we'll get inflammatory markers, and then typical, you know, CBC, of course, CBC, CMP. We want to see what those white blood cells are doing. We want to see what the metabolic panel looks like. A total IgG might be helpful. That could be a good marker to get, and blood sugar markers. So we'll want a glucose, hemoglobin A1C, and fasting insulin would be a good minimal panel to get started with there to get a sense for what's going on in the metabolism. And we know that certain cancers have, you know, some, there, of course, sugar impacts cancers, and that's something that we want to look at blood sugar, we want to look at metabolism, and we want to see how does the metabolism look overall. So another thing we're going to want to look at is we're going to want to look at what's an initial supplement protocol. And before I get into an initial supplement protocol, I do want to answer a little bit about the question around, there was the question around, to what degree is there a link between mold and cancer? And as far as I'm aware, there's not a robust body of literature on this, but certainly there's a chronic inflammatory response that occurs and result from mold exposure, especially in genetically susceptible individuals. And that chronic inflammatory response is going to contribute to an overall increased propensity towards autoimmune diseases, cancers, neurodegenerative diseases, and we're going to potentially see an increase in those as a result. There's also some evidence linking, there's very clear evidence linking mold toxicity to Alzheimer's and dementia, because we do see increased Marcons, or multiple antibiotic resistant coagulative negative staph, in the rhinobiome and the sinus cavities. And that's been linked to amyloid plaque on the brain, and amyloid plaque's been linked to Alzheimer's and dementia. So mold toxin illness and or chronic infection like Lyme and co-infections are, for example, one of three big categories that some of the big Alzheimer's people are talking about today as one of the big root causes. So there are inflammatory root causes, there are metabolic root causes, and then there are root causes related to mold and chronic infection for Alzheimer's and dementia. So for neurodegenerative disease, that's something to consider. When we're looking at cancer, we definitely want to consider inflammation and oxidative stress from various sources. And when we're dealing with excessive toxin exposure, that's going to be one of the things. There are some mycotoxins that have been shown carcinogenic, so that would be absolutely a contributor to cancer. There's potentially also some, there's some evidence, and it's pretty limited at this point, but there's some evidence that there may be electromagnetic field contribution to certain breast cancers, especially when a woman keeps her cell phone in her bra. So that's something to be aware of and just, you know, ask about and help people to get into the habit of putting the cell phone into airplane mode when keeping it on the body. So we want to look at exposures of various sorts. We want to look at toxin exposures, chemical exposures. We want to look at toxic emotional exposures, and we want to look at toxic relationships. We want to look at exposures to electromagnetic fields as well. So exposures are going to be a big part of what we're going to look at. And then we're going to look at mental emotional piece. We're going to look at diet. We're going to look at supplements. So supplements, one of the things that can be very helpful that is kind of on the borderline between a supplement and a food product is flax seeds. 1 tablespoon BID, so twice a day, and that's going to be ground flaxseed. And what's interesting is that although flaxseed's a phytoestrogen and you would think it might have an estrogenic effect, there have been studies that have shown that it's been an estrogen reducing effect if there's an estrogen dominant cancer. So phytoestrogens are going to be less strong than endogenous estrogens. So if endogenous estrogens are dominant and we're seeing high levels, then what flaxseed will do is it will reduce the impacts of estrogen because the phytoestrogen is weaker than the endogenous estrogen. But in the opposite situation where estrogen is too low, let's say a woman's going through menopause, estrogen's too low, she doesn't have a hormone-based cancer, flaxseed will add phytoestrogens that will bind to receptors that are currently unbound because there's a deficiency, and it will help bring the effect of estrogen up a bit. So it's kind of adaptogenic in its hormone relationship, and it has specific research with breast cancer that's hormone sensitive. So I do feel confident because of that research in supplementing with ground flax seeds in the case of someone who has an estrogen dominant breast cancer. I also feel that sulforaphane is appropriate and potentially helpful to supplement with as well. And sulforaphane is a constituent in cruciferous vegetables, and it is highest in broccoli sprouts and next highest in broccoli, and then other cruciferous vegetables have some in it as well. And it's actually glucoraphin that are in these vegetables, and that gets combined with the myrosinase enzyme to make sulforaphane. So sulforaphane can be from food product if someone eats broccoli sprouts raw or blanched for about 30 seconds to a minute in boiling water, then they will get both the myrosinase enzyme and the glucoraphin and produce sulforaphane. If someone cooks broccoli or broccoli sprouts for too long, they will break down the myrosinase enzyme and they'll get the glucoraphin, but it won't convert into the active sulforaphane. One way around this is to cook broccoli, but have some raw crucifer together with the broccoli, like, for example, a little bit of daikon radish or horseradish or mustard or arugula. And any of those will add some myrosinase enzyme and will help with producing sulforaphane. Sulforaphane can also be used as a supplement. So you can use a sulforaphane product, for example, Oncoplex by Zymogen is one sulforaphane product that you can use, or Broccoprotect by Designs for Health is another sulforaphane product that you can use. So we see that sulforaphane can be a supplement that you can use as a supplement, or you can get it from food. And it's good to know that, because oftentimes when someone's working with an oncologist, the oncologist tends to be okay with food, but not okay with supplements. So it depends on the oncologist and the open-mindedness of the oncologist. It also depends on the client and what they want to communicate with the oncologist or not. And that's something that everyone has to consider on a case-by-case basis and work with people, communicate and dialogue around this, and let people be an advocate for themselves, because they should be able to have a say in their treatment. And it is good to be under the care of an oncologist as well. I mean, depending on the kind of cancer, outcomes are a little different. So you're going to want to have a dialogue about with people, find their own way that they want to interact and engage with you, with the oncologist, with different members of the care team, and find a strategy with open dialogue with the client that's going to work for them. Have some things that are food-based things and supplement-based things so that you can go back and forth between those things. So ground flaxseed is going to be good in most cases. Sulforaphane, or, you know, and we'll say DIM also. DIM is generally lowering estrogen, and it's helping push estrogen converting into the less cancer-causing type of estrogen. So we have the 2OH, the 4OH, the 16OH pathways, which I see we have a question about that. And so the question is a little bit related to someone who's got elevated 4OH estrogen dominance and breast cysts, but no cancer diagnosis. So we'll get a little more in detail in that case after this one. But I will say that DIM in general, for both cases, is going to be an important nutrient potentially to help with the estrogen levels going down and the estrogen type pushing in the appropriate direction. So that's something to consider, is sulforaphane and DIM in supplement and or food forms are going to be potentially helpful. While we're on this food supplement discussion, I will say generally that powders might be a little better tolerated by, again, an oncologist who's concerned. If someone can put it in their smoothie and, you know, it looks a little closer to a food-based product, they may wind up being a little more okay with it than something that's a pill that someone's taking. So another thing to consider is powders. For example, we might consider a mushroom extract, and we might consider a mushroom extract powder like reishi, for example. And we could give reishi as pills, but if we're doing it as a mushroom extract powder and a person's mixing it into a smoothie or mixing it with hot water and making a tea, that may be less of an issue for an oncologist as opposed to taking capsules or even a tincture. So reishi powder, I like Primal Herb is a good brand of, they have a reishi product. And I think it's called Reishi Supreme or Reishi Complex or something like that. And it mixes some Reishi extract with Reishi spore, and it has a pretty high concentration to it. So that's a good powder. Now, you can get products that are just beta-glucan, and beta-glucan is the active constituent in mushrooms that are thought to have some of that positive impact. So, you know, Immunotics is, I believe, the name of the Zymogen product that has a high beta-glucan content in it. And that would be something to look at as an option if someone was wanting a pill, they weren't going to tolerate the powder, and the oncologist was okay with doing something like this, then you might add something like Immunotics or a beta-glucan high concentrate extract in there. So Reishi powder would be one that I would be considering, and or Immunotics as a way to help with immune stimulation. Another thing to consider in a case like this is going to be to look at general antioxidants. You might think about curcumin extracts and like a BCM95, which a lot of products have BCM95 in it, and that's just 95% curcuminoid, so it's an extract that's pretty strong on the curcuminoid side of things. So that would be something to consider in this case, is looking at a curcumin product, and the most research that I've seen is on the BCM95 form, so that would be something to consider in this case. Also, you might consider something like grape seed extract, and don't confuse this with grapefruit seed extract, but grape seed extract. And that would be something to consider because basically grape seed extract is a very, very strong antioxidant. It's stronger than vitamin C by many fold, and it works in a hormetic way that's probably going to be a little bit better than a synthetic antioxidant for mitochondrial function. So that's something to consider and look at as well. And vitamin D is something that we want to measure the levels before we mess with too much, but there have been several research trials linking vitamin D levels and breast cancer specifically. So it would be helpful to take a look at vitamin D levels and parathyroid hormone levels and see where they're at. And if the vitamin D levels are below 35, we'll definitely want to intervene. If the parathyroid hormone levels are above 30, then we may also want to raise vitamin D levels. So that's going to be something to be considering as well. And so we're going to want to generally think about vitamin D, antioxidants. We're going to want to think about things that can help with detoxification, especially from toxic burden. It's also worth considering melatonin. Now, melatonin is a hormone, so this is going to be, there's a decent amount of research with melatonin in cancer, so oncologists may be open to it. You just have to, you know, it's a case-by-case basis where you have to talk to the person, and they may want to talk to the oncologist. You may want to figure out what to do in that case. But melatonin is something to consider, and you can look at melatonin as something that can have some anti-cancer effect. And some people are going quite high doses on melatonin. I've heard of extreme doses. So melatonin would be you know, for sleep, maybe half a milligram or 1 milligram or 3 milligrams, or maybe at the most 5 milligrams would be, you know, a reasonable dose of melatonin for sleep. Some practitioners are going into doses that are much, 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 much higher than that, 500 milligram, 1 gram, even up to 6 gram doses. Now that's extreme. That's not what I'm recommending, but I will say that some practitioners are doing that. And I would only consider that kind of dosing if it were, you know, a terminal cancer and there was no treatment options, you know, then I'd be considering something like that. And I'd talk to someone about something like that. But of course, you know, so it depends what the prognosis is as to what we're going to do in this case. But we may go, you know, with something like a dose of 30 milligrams or, you know, 6 milligrams, 6 to 30 milligrams would be, you know, a reasonable dose to do, depending again on prognosis, depending on other treatment methods, depending on the comfort of the oncologist. This is, as you can tell, a bit of a delicate discussion, and it's a bit of a negotiation with the patient and negotiation with their process and, you know, finding out what they want to do themselves. And these supplements that I'm giving you here, these aren't like the, you know, best supplements to use, because these are the supplements that are for the diagnosis of cancer, but we really want to look at the underlying root causes. We want to look at the toxic burden. We want to look at the mold exposure. We want to look at the gut. These are going to be some of the bigger things to treat, and hopefully you already have some training. We don't have labs in this case to go deeper into that, but that would be something to you know, consider that you want to look at. So I'm getting a question: what is the mechanism of action for melatonin? And there's evidence that melatonin downregulates some of the pituitary and gonadal hormones that control mammary gland development and are responsible of growth of hormone-dependent mammary tumors. There's also a theory that it could act directly on tumoral cells, that it could be naturally anti-estrogen and could influence the rate of proliferation of tumors as a result of being anti-estrogen. And there's also some reports of low melatonin plasma concentrations in women with estrogen receptor positive breast cancers. And there's maybe, I mean, there's research is a little scarce, right? So we have a pretty decent amount of animal model studies, but the problem with animal model studies is that when, for drug companies, when they get a positive response in animals, it's about a 92% failure rate that it translates into humans. So we have to be careful with animal studies. So it's really tough to say the role that melatonin is going to play, even though it has some mechanisms that look promising for being anti-estrogenic, anti-tumor, for helping to downregulate pituitary and help some of those hormones that are involved in some of those tumors. So it's, you know, going to be, and then it has an antioxidative effect as well. There's not a robust enough body of clinical trials to say for sure, but we don't have a lot that we can say for sure in human trials it's effective. So what that means is that we want to you know, we want to look at all our options. We want to get those options on the table. We want to look at things that might be promising, but we'll want to not rely too heavily on those because we don't know what effect they're going to have. But the basic mechanism is going to be there's, you know, potentially an inhibition of cell proliferation. There's some proteins that are increased that modulate the length of cell cycles. There's a potential reduction in the metastatic capacity of cells. And there may be a direct inhibition of the stimulatory effect of estrogen. And so there's some good mechanistic possibilities for why melatonin may be helpful here. And hopefully that gives you a sense for the mechanisms there. And I think, you know, we need more studies, but it's potentially promising. If it is a terminal cancer and you're going with higher dose, there are some topical versions where you can get higher dose. So you might look at topical in the case of trying to get higher dose melatonin. So that's something to consider. Then on the supplement side, those are the biggest things. You know, there's some research on soy. It's probably similar to flaxseed in its effect with the phytoestrogen. And so, you know, because soy is more immunogenic, I don't usually recommend that route, but, you know, that's a possible thing for some people to consider. Of course, increasing vegetable and fruit consumption on the dietary front actually has some research behind it. Polyphenols from coffee have a little research behind it. Omega-3 fatty acids have a little research behind it. Resveratrol does, but animal models haven't been panning out for humans, so I'm not usually recommending it. Vitamin C has a little bit of research. Green tea extract, a little bit of research. So there are a lot of things that have a little bit of research. Generally, if you think, you know, about looking at, you know, some phytoestrogens, lignans, things from flaxseed, some things from cruciferous vegetables like sulforaphane dim, some of the mushroom extracts, and some of the things like curcumin and antioxidants and vitamin D and melatonin. That's going to be a pretty decent beginning stack for people to look at supplements that are directly targeting. And then, of course, the main focus should also be on looking at diet, looking at lifestyle, looking at environmental exposure, chemical exposure, looking at gut issues as well. So now let's take a look at some of the dietary recommendations. I'm spending a lot of time on this because, you know, a lot of this is going to apply to other cancers as well. And I know a lot of you are going to be dealing with people who have cancer, even if they're not there to work with you because of the cancer. Maybe they're having a gut issue or having another thing, or maybe they want a functional provider on their team for doing some of the care on cancer. So I really want you to have a thorough sense for this because it is a significant issue. And I think most practitioners or clinicians are going to see this in some of their clients and maybe some friends and family members as well. So some of the dietary recommendations, I want to have a discussion on keto diet. And the discussion is that basically there are stages, there are types of cancers, and those types of cancers are faster or slower growing cancers. And then there are stages of cancers, and those stages will depend on whether the cancer is more what we might loosely term anabolic or catabolic. Is the cancer in more of a building up state or a breaking down state? Most people think of cancers as anabolic because they're spreading and growing, but cancers start that way, but then become catabolic and are breaking down cells and tissues at some point. And that point gets accelerated when radiation or chemotherapy is involved. As soon as radiation or chemotherapy is involved, the cancer shifts, cancer metabolism shifts, and it becomes more catabolic in its effect. So that's something to consider, is where is the cancer at? And where the cancer is at is going to depend on the kind of diet that we're going to recommend. And so when we're going to recommend keto diet is usually earlier in diagnosis and usually with faster growing cancers. So if it's been diagnosed early, meaning it's not already a stage 2 or 3 or 4 cancer, you know, especially not stage 3 or 4, then we may be looking at keto diet being more effective. And if it's a faster growing cancer, we may look at it being more effective. It's most researched for brain cancer. And so early stage brain cancer gets pretty remarkable impact in a positive direction from ketogenic diet. So I'd highly recommend it with early stage brain cancer. Early stage breast cancer may respond very well to a keto diet also. But later stage breast cancer may not. So has a person undergone chemo or radiation? If so, then it's more of a catabolic state and we're not going to want to use a ketogenic diet. If it's very early stage, faster growing, we may want to use the keto diet. We definitely want to have an anti-inflammatory diet. We want to have lots of cruciferous veggies, and in general, veggies and fruits, in parentheses, you know, depending on stage of cancer and types of fruits. So again, if we're doing a keto diet, obviously we're not going to have much fruits. But if, you know, a cancer's in its catabolic stage, we are going to want to consider extra fruits for the polyphenols, especially the ones that are deeply colored, brightly colored, like pomegranate and berries. These are going to be very phytonutrient rich and probably of net benefit. So in general, we're going to want to, you know, a nice dietary template for the non-ketogenic phase of cancer treatment when we're looking at diet. A nice template is looking at Terry Walls. I'm not sure how you spell Walls. Let me... HLS, that's right. Okay. So Terry Walls has a diet that was based on her autoimmune disease and helped her recover. But it's nice because it outlines what people should have. It also talks about what they shouldn't, but there's quite a bit of emphasis on having lots and lots of cups of vegetables, and it classifies vegetables into sulfur-rich vegetables, leafy greens, and brightly colored fruits and vegetables. And it's recommending generally, you know, at least 3 and as much as 6 to 9, you know, cups and of each category. And so, you know, when we're dealing with, let's say, 3 to 5 cups of each category, that's, you know, 9 to 15 cups of fruits and vegetables a day. That's a lot. But imagine all of the nutrients that we're getting from that. So in terms of having a therapeutic diet, that can be helpful. And then basically she recommends kind of like a paleo type of diet with lots and lots of fruits and veggies. And that's a pretty decent template for the non-keto portion for people. Now, that is, there's one part of the Terry Walls diet, which is lots and lots and lots of bone broth that may not be the best for cancer. And it may be fine, but there's some concern around glutamine and cancer. So I certainly wouldn't dose glutamine as a supplement high in cancer, because there is some evidence suggesting glutamine being a food for cancer. I'm not super concerned with bone broth as a whole food. I think that the whole food part of it's probably going to be, helpful to the net benefit may outweigh any potential detriment that would come from that, is my guess. But I want to give that caveat that glutamine itself can be a problem. And if something is high in glutamine, we may want to consider that. So Terry Walls might be a reasonable template to follow on cancers when you're in the phase of treatment where you're looking at the catabolic type or time within cancer treatment. So one other thing that I'll mention here is choline. And choline is going to be a nutrient that, in particular, if mold shows up here, is going to be an important nutrient. It's fuel for cell membranes. It's involved in bile formation. It helps with detoxification. It helps with brain and cognitive function. And so phosphatidylcholine is something to consider. It's not necessarily going to be directly helpful, but I want to mention it because it may become very helpful. And assessing for choline deficiency, I think, to be way underdone in general for anyone, for any condition. And I believe that choline would be potentially helpful to assess for, is there an adequate amount in the diet? And of course, when there are methylation issues and detoxification issues, choline needs, they can double, and people often aren't getting enough in the first place. So depending on whether people are eating eggs and tolerate eggs, or if they eat liver, is going to depend on the amount of choline that they get. But I would think about a phosphatidylcholine supplement if someone's not intaking enough choline from diet. And so if they're not going through, especially if they have methylation issues, they should be going at least through, more than a dozen eggs per week. And it's the yolks that have choline. And ideally also a little bit of liver to get an adequate choline requirement. Now, it depends on what else they're eating, and their other things do have choline. It depends, are they taking any lecithin? Are they taking any, choline supplements? So there's a lot to consider, but I'd like to see people, ideally getting a pretty decent dose of choline from some combination of diet from egg yolks and liver primarily. And if not, then to look at a choline supplement as an option. Now, you can consider on the supplement front anti-inflammatory powders. Just be cautious, because a lot of them have a lot of glutamine in them. So I try and look at anti-inflammatory powders, and I end up being steered away from them sometimes because of the glutamine content. But there are, especially if we're dealing with an oncologist who says, hey, smoothie stuff is okay, but supplements aren't, then we may look more at an anti-inflammatory powder as part of what we're doing for someone on the supplement side of things. So back to the mold discussion, I think this is a critical piece. I've seen, and this is anecdotal, but I've seen a link anecdotally between people with mold exposure and cancer. And we know some carcinogenic mechanisms of some mycotoxins. And so I personally believe this to be a strong link, but I don't see research that's been done, and I don't know if and when research will be done on this. But I believe that probably in a reasonable number of cases, there may be some net benefit to doing mold testing, looking at the home, looking at the workplace, looking at the HLA-DR and TGF-beta-1 markers, or a urine mycotoxin test, and getting a sense for whether mold might be involved in the picture, using binders to bind mold toxin, and helping to get a person to detoxify appropriately. So we might be thinking about, you know, depending on labs, we might be thinking about things like activated charcoal, cyto detox, or other purified, and I say purified because zeolite can be contaminated with lead, so we want a purified form. If we're going to use that, we may be thinking about things like chitosan, clay, but again, purified, making sure the sourcing's good on that. So these might be things that we'd be considering. And then chlorella is often very safe. It's a food product, so we might be thinking about chlorella. I see Jen's asking, would we consider the carcinogenic properties of grilled meat? Should all grilled meats be avoided? And yes, we would be thinking about anything that are known carcinogens. And so absolutely, it would be worth considering. It would be worth considering carcinogenic compounds, and grilling would be one thing that I would recommend avoiding. If not avoiding, then, you know, really it's the charred part that's the problem. So really grilling low and slow rather than high and fast, and avoiding, you know, minimizing as much charred part as possible. So that's going to potentially be helpful, is the charred part, and avoiding that. So I want to talk about exposures now. So we want to look at toxins, chemicals, pesticides. I know pesticides, you know, can be chemicals and toxins, but I'm just going to class it there. We want to look at personal care products. We want to look at cleaning products. We want to look at environmental exposures. And that's going to be mold, lead, asbestos, radon, etc. We want to look at charred food. We want to look at food in general. We want to look at water. We want to look at air. We want to look at the electromagnetic, or EMFs, as well. So toxins, we're going to be looking in particular in this case for mold toxin. We're also going to be wanting to assess for exposures that are going to be related to things like, you know, lead paint in a home, asbestos or radon, or other environmental exposures. So these would be things to consider: volatile organic compounds from building materials, if someone's, you know, recently refinished a floor or they're moving into a new home, there's going to be a lot of off-gassing. If they work in a place where there's off-gassing, there's a lot of construction happening or there are chemicals being used, that's something we want to look for. We want to look for what people are putting on and in their bodies. So we want to look at food for what they're putting in their bodies and water and air they're breathing in. We want to look at what they're putting on their bodies. So personal care products and environmental working groups, a great tool here, but we want to get pretty rigid with people with cancer diagnoses in avoidance of toxin exposure, not so rigid that a person's creating extra stress, but rigid enough that they're minimizing things that they have easy control over. For example, they're not storing things in plastics that are, you know, endocrine disrupting chemicals. And they're using glass or stainless steel containers for water and things they're storing in their fridge. We want to help people to choose personal care products and cleaning products that are non-toxic and safe. We want to help people to assess for whether they're in environmental exposure of toxins. So maybe doing a mold test on the home, like a Hertzme or Ermi test, and on their workplace would be helpful to assess for if they're in mold exposure at home or at work. And doing some assessment of if their house is, you know, built before the 70s, were they, you know, what's the history on the paint, and is there any reason why paint may be flaking, chipping, leading to lead exposure? We may look at labs to help look at metal exposure and then try to source or figure out what sources might be happening of those exposures. We'll want to look at air purification, because if someone's living, especially in a city, there's going to be a lot of air pollutants, and we want to minimize the exposure to those pollutants during the day at home and at work and in the car. So we'll want to look at air purifiers for the home, the car, and the work. For home, I like IQ Air or Air Doctor or Austin are all good brands. EnviroCleanse is another one. And for home and work, those are great solutions. For the office, sometimes if a big air purifier isn't an option, there are desk purifiers. Like IQ Air makes one called Atom Desk, and that's one to consider. For the car, Atom Car is a great air purifier. So that's ATEM for car and or desk. And then we have IQ Air, Austin, or Air Doctor are options for in the home and at work. Water, we want to consider purification and things like multi-pure or reverse osmosis. Multi-pure is a carbon block, so it doesn't remove minerals. Reverse osmosis does remove minerals, so we may want to add minerals back in with a post-mineral filter, remineralizing filter after it goes through reverse osmosis. That's probably the better solution than having people add minerals to their water, because are they going to add minerals every single time? I'm not so sure. So I like a mineralization filter after it goes through reverse osmosis if we're going to use that filtration method, or a Berkey is a good one. And Berkey makes a travel filter, so people can get a Berkey travel filter, and it fits in a suitcase, a standard carry-on suitcase. You can fold it up. It does get checked by security every time, every single time, 100% of the time that I've brought my travel Berkey through security, they check it. It's gotten to the point where I take it out of the bag, I put it in its own bin, because I know they're going to check it, and they will check it and ask what it is, and I'll tell them it's a water purifier, and they'll say okay and let me go on. But they will check it every time. So know that ahead of time. I get the travel Berkey. I added the fluoride filters onto it. And then it's really nice to take to hotel rooms. It's nice to take camping. It's nice to take if it's car camping and not backpacking. So it's nice to take to various places to not have to buy water bottles and be able to purify your own water. So those are all good options on water. Food, of course, choose organic when possible. Follow Clean 15, Dirty Dozen. If not doing all organic, ideally do all organic, grass-fed, pasture-raised. I think you guys know all this stuff, so I'm not going to belabor that point. Just good food choices in general to minimize pesticide exposure, of course. Electromagnetic frequencies, definitely one to consider, and I would definitely be putting some emphasis on. And I would recommend carrying the phone on airplane mode whenever it's on the body and keeping it off the body when it's on and using some air tube headset where basically the headset will, it has a little air tube. So the electromagnetic frequency from the headset goes a certain distance and then there's an air tube for the rest of the distance, and that minimizes electromagnetic exposure to the head. So that would be a good headset to use as an air tube. And then and when putting the phone in airplane mode, also turning off Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, as long as they're not needed. So that would be helpful to do as well. And then putting the Wi-Fi router on a timer at night so that it automatically goes off, you know, whenever people know they're going to be done using it. Like at my house, it goes off, you know, around 11:45 p.m. and then it goes on at 6 a.m. So it doesn't impact the workflow, but it does go off during sleeping hours. So that's something that people can do. Plus it prevents people from working too late or too early in the morning also, or wire things for internet and make it so that you don't need a Wi-Fi router. So those are things to consider on electromagnetic frequencies. There's more, there's dirty electricity, there's considerations around smart meters, there's what's plugged in your bedroom, there's, you know, your phone going in airplane mode at night, there's all sorts of stuff. So, you know, it's important to address electromagnetic frequencies, and the biggest, heaviest hitters are put the phone in airplane mode when you're carrying it on your body, on your person, and use a AirPods headset, put the Wi-Fi router off at night on an automatic timer. It's like $12 to buy one of those timers or less. So just put it on an automatic timer and then turn your phone into airplane mode, turn off Bluetooth and Wi-Fi at night, every night, and make that a habit. Those are going to be the biggest, heaviest hitters. Good place to start for people. And that would be a really great thing for people to do. If they want to take it deeper, they can look at a device to read levels in their home and they can measure those levels, and they want to keep for sure below 1 milligauss in the bedroom. At night, better if it's substantially lower, and ideally below 3, better if it can be below 1 where a person's working. And again, wiring internet's a big help on that, because the computer will be its own Wi-Fi router essentially if it's picking up Wi-Fi. So it's going to output a lot from picking up Wi-Fi. So if you turn Wi-Fi off on your computer and plug it into the wired when you're working, that can be a big help, as well as putting the phone further away from you or in airplane mode if you don't need it to be on. And those are going to be things that are worth considering for places that people are going to spend a lot of time. So personal care products, I like Environmental Working Group for those. Sunscreen's a whole consideration. Sunscreens can have negative impacts, and so consider sunscreen use. Don't use, you know, use don't use sunscreen when you don't need to. And when you do need to, use the zinc oxide, but not the nanoparticles. And so that's a basic on sunscreen. And again, look at environmental working group. Cleaning products, look at environmental working group. The other day I was looking at dishwasher detergents on environmental working group and discovered that there aren't a whole lot of them that get A's, but A's and B's. So you have to look, but there were a few that got A's, and interestingly, I was surprised to find that Kirkland brand, which is Costco's brand, got a B, which I thought it would have gotten worse. So it's good to evaluate environmental working group and see what products get. Cleaning product that I assumed was good and bought was Simple Green, and then I went on to environmental working group and found that it was either a D rating or an F. It was not a good rating, and so made me realize that even something that's advertising itself to be green may be an issue. So I do like to cross-reference with environmental working group to determine if a product is going to be safe. And I like to guide clients through that process of how to work with navigating the environmental working group website and being able to reference products, on their phone while they're in the store before they buy them, or use a store where they have a good return policy and check them before they open them. So that's a good thing to educate people about. And then, of course, the charred food thing we already brought up and mentioned, water purification, air purification, and then, getting rid of mold in a home. So either remediating or moving. And that's a big deal, but it's worth doing for people. It really is. And so that's something to consider on the mold side of things. And then past exposures, getting a history of exposures, looking at amalgam removal, safe amalgam removal is going to be another player in there. So, just covering all the bases, looking at exposures and considering exposures really significantly in these cases with cancer, and doing everything you can on the exposure side, the diet side, also looking at the supplement side, and then doing some lab testing for underlying root cause issues and resolving those. So that should give you a pretty good overview on this case and cancer in general and some of the big considerations to think through. And I'm sure there's a lot more. The metabolic side is huge. And so once you have some of these other lab markers, for this case, if you submit them, we can go in more detail on what do we do once we have those markers in. So please do submit those, and that'll be helpful for us to dive a little deeper here. So on to Jen's question about cancer prevention in a woman with elevated 4-OH, estrogen dominance, and breast cysts, but no cancer diagnosis. So in this case, so we have estrogen dominance, 4-OH excess, and breast cysts, no cancer DX. So in this case, we're going to want to consider, we're definitely going to want to look at on the supplement side, in addition to all the other stuff we talked about, a lot of it applies. We're going to want to consider DIM, because DIM can help push the 2-OH pathway and reduce the 4-OH pathway for estrogen detox. We're going to want to consider methylation and how estrogen is getting methylated. So we might want to look at homocysteine level in the blood. We might want to consider a B complex. So we'll want to look at a B complex with methylated B vitamins, we'll want to look at choline, we'll want to look at, and the B complex has B2 in it, and B2 is going to be really important for methylation in addition to, you know, folate and B12 and B6. B2 often isn't missing from that discussion, but there's been research showing B2 might actually solve more MTHFR things than folate, than methylated folate itself. So B2 would be important to get in there. So I like a B complex with methylated B vitamins. Choline. And potentially creatine. And creatine spares SAMe, and it's going to help with methylation. It also helps with depression, which can be sometimes going with some of these hormone pictures. It is potentially also going to improve fitness and muscle ATP. So that's a side benefit, and cognitive function is a side benefit. But creatine would be another consideration. And Jen's asking for DIM, what if you want an E3 are low and E2 is mid-range? Will DIM have a estrogen lowering effect that is going to outweigh the net benefit of the moving of the pathway over to 2OH from 4OH? And she's 45 and approaching menopause too. So DIM can have an estrogen lowering effect. The net benefit, I would argue, would be worthwhile, because DIM tends to, although it can lower estrogen a little bit, especially in a dose like 100 milligrams a day, it's not going to lower estrogen a ton, but it is going to push the right pathway. It may lower estrogen a little bit, but probably not going to be to the net detriment when we're considering the advantage of pushing the right pathway. So I would consider still 100 milligram per day dose. And as someone's moving into menopause, we may consider some, you know, because estrogen is dominant, we may look at Vitex/Chase-3, and we may look at a dose of that that's going to be significant, that's going to help bring those progesterone levels up a bit, so that we don't get the, you know, relative drop of progesterone faster than estrogen that tends to happen and cause some of the menopausal symptoms. The dose on creatine is going to be 5 grams per day. And that's a pretty good dose. Some people do a loading dose on creatine of 20 grams for the first week or two and then go down. You can do that if you want. I just do 5 grams because I figure people are going to take it for long enough. They're going to get loaded over time. It may take a few weeks. I do let people know they may gain some water weight on creatine, and that's normal. And that water will go to the muscles eventually. So after a couple of weeks, it'll go to the muscles. So if they notice they're gaining a little water weight and it's all over the place, especially for women, I like to prep them that it will go into the muscles and it will make the muscles look bigger and not overall their body look bigger. So it takes a little time, but it does go in that direction. And because transitioning into menopause, also flaxseed, 1 tablespoon, twice a day will be helpful, because again, it helps with low estrogen or high estrogen. So it's really a nice regulator in that way. So I would add flaxseed at a tablespoon twice a day in this case as well, so that we can offset any, you know, effect of estrogen lowering that DIM is having, plus the transition to menopause may also already be having. And then the Vitex can help the HPO axis and bring up the progesterone levels to prevent some of that estrogen dominance effect as well. So we would be considering methylation, so the B complex, choline, creatine. We'd be considering Vitex or Chase-3. That's the same thing. We'd be considering flaxseed a tablespoon twice a day and DIM 100 milligrams. Also, because there are cysts, we're going to look at iodine. And iodine is something that we're going to want to monitor thyroid when we're playing with iodine a whole lot. But we're going to want to ideally get iodine doses up to a level where thyroid is still stable, but we're able to have an impact on on cyst formation and fibroids. Sometimes I'll have people topically apply iodine locally to the breasts. And if you're applying iodine topically to the breasts, some of it will evaporate off. So in order to increase absorption, sometimes people can put, so some people put Saran wrap over, and I get a little nervous about putting plastic right on the body, but you know, without heat or acidity, it probably isn't going to transmit too much of the chemicals into the body. So I feel okay about that, unless, you know, it's really hot out or, you know, people are applying heat, then I recommend not doing it. So that's one way to go, or you can just apply topically iodine and let absorb what's going to absorb. And that's local application of iodine. There's also internal taking of iodine, and that's okay too. But again, we need to watch thyroid function. Generally, up to 1 milligram, well tolerated without thyroid detriment. Once we get above 1 milligram, sometimes we see thyroid, sometimes we see TSH start to go up. So we can go, you know, 3 milligrams iodine, you know, is often a reasonable dose to work up to if testing TSH and it remains normal. I'm not a huge fan of the crazy high doses that go up to 50 milligrams. I think that's a little bit too high in general for most people. I've seen too many thyroids go haywire. I'm open to, you know, people self-experimenting, but I'm generally not recommending it in my practice. And I would, you know, typically like to see for a while if we can get results more in the 1 to 3 milligram range. Occasionally we might go higher than 3 milligrams while monitoring thyroid. But again, you know, this would be something where, hey, we're going to do an experiment, but we're going to really monitor thyroid symptoms, and stop the experiment and go back down if we get those thyroid symptoms. Is there a specific form of iodine to use? So I don't, so there's iodide, there's iodine, there's kelp extracts, there's nascent iodine, there's, gosh, there's a lot, and nascent is like magnetically charged, and I have researched this, and I've come away a little more confused than when I started. So I don't know if there's a proper form to use. I typically, sometimes I'll use nascent, which is a topical form, and you know, they claim it's magnetically charged and spun in a correct direction, and you know, the difference, I've not seen a difference, honestly, but you know, I think it's a reasonable form. It's in a tincture. You're really looking at drop dosing to get to that dose, and you have to do a little conversion, but I believe it's about 400 micrograms per drop if I'm remembering correctly. And so that would be about 3 drops would be 1.2 milligrams. So, you know, we're looking at a pretty small dose of that for internal use. If we're using topical, we can go a little higher because they're not going to absorb it fully. But again, we're going to want to monitor TSH. And so I sometimes use nascent. Vinco has a liposomal iodine that I'll sometimes use. And so you can consider using either of those. Some people use Lugol's. I generally don't. It's not available on the professional website, so it's not so easy to order. And, you know, I'm not convinced it's any better. They make it 2.5% and 5%, and it can get really big doses real quick. So again, we have to be careful about the dosing and do drop dosing, and that's okay to do. But, you know, I think I prefer not the 5% typically. So if we're going Lugol's, to go 2.5%. Kelp capsules are sometimes a reasonable way to go, just straight kelp capsules, as long as we know the iodine dose and we take some time and work up slowly with those. It's kind of nice because we can work up more slowly and have a more controlled dose on those. But, you know, you may work up to 20 capsules or more if you're going to these higher doses, in which case sometimes people appreciate more of the simplicity of kelp, of the liquids. So when I'm doing a liquid, I will generally start small for 1 to 3 weeks and then go a little bigger. So we might do 1 drop for 1 week and then 2 drops for 1 week and then 3 drops for 1 week and then retest thyroid and have people monitor symptoms along the way. And then we'll, if TSH remains normal, we might continue to go up a little bit in some cases from there. And I will say that I had a woman with fibrocystic breasts. She was really clean on her diet, and we discovered mold, and she got out of her moldy environment. We also did iodine. That may have helped some, but getting out of the moldy environment was like by far the biggest thing that helped her dramatically. And even though we had done Vitex, even though we had done iodine and those things were helping some, we hadn't dealt with the core. So I really want to emphasize to you, get to the core, get to the root, do some of the testing to figure out what these underlying root causes are. Please, you know, do that work. It's worthwhile. And sometimes you'll see the biggest headway from doing something like getting someone out of a moldy environment, dealing with a gut issue, dealing with a chronic infection. Can we still use iodine topically with Hashimoto's? So the deal with Hashimoto's is people are afraid to use iodine with it because increased iodine has been associated with increased Hashimoto's, and that is true in research. And I am cautious with iodine around the Hashimoto's. And iodine restriction can sometimes be helpful with Hashimoto's. And that being said, a dose of maybe 300-400 micrograms a day may be okay with Hashimoto's and not make things worse, and maybe helpful in some cases. So I'm not dogmatic about being low dose on Hashimoto's. I would consider topical, but I would start low and slow, and I do testing along the way, and I test antibodies as well as TSH in that case. And if antibodies start to raise, I would lower the dose or stop, and I would be looking at other things. One thing to note about Hashimoto's is that there is some newer research that's come out about aloe vera extracts and lowering antibodies. So I'm now adding in aloe vera extracts to lower antibodies. And we've put together a formula in the clinic that's shown some amazing results. And it's called ThyReg. And it's one of our custom formulas that you can get access to. If you open an account with us, we can get you access to that. And I'll give you a quick brief on one case study using ThyReg. So we had a client use it, and her first lab came back with she had thyroid peroxidase antibody of 180 and thyroglobulin antibody of 410, TSH of 3.48, free T3 of 2.9 was her original lab. And then after treatment with ThyReg, we did a follow-up. 4 months, a little under 4 months later, so 3 months and change later. And thyroglobulin went from 410 to 382. TPO went from 180 to 166. And TSH remained the same. Free T3 remained the same. And then we did another follow-up about 5 months later. And 5 months later, thyroid peroxidase was 124. So it was 180, and then it was 166 less than 4 months later. And then about 5 months after that, it was 124. So 180, 166, 124. Thyroglobulin antibody TGA went from 410 to 382 to 310. And TSH was about 3.5, and then it was about 3.6, and then it was 2.4. And free T3 remained at 2.9. So, you know, that was a pretty amazing change in TPO antibodies and TGA antibodies that we witnessed for her, especially since she hadn't been completely sticking with the dietary plan, but she had been taking the thyreg. So we saw some pretty incredible results there. We still have a little ways to go. I'd like to see that. So the TSH got into about perfect range. The free T3 could come up a little bit still. So, you know, we'd like to see a little improvement there, but the antibodies are on a steady trend downward, which is fantastic in that case. I also saw another case where free T3 went up dramatically when taking thyreg. So I've been really impressed so far. It's a fairly new product, so we're still in the experimental zone with it, but it's something that shows a lot of promise, and I'm really excited about it. So that would be something to potentially trial as well. And aloe vera and selenium and potentially ashwagandha would all be other reasonable things to trial, and then making sure there's adequate zinc, doing gut work, doing toxin work, looking at chronic infections, all are going to be important as well in that case, and looking for antiparietal cell antibodies, because 20 to 40% of people with hypothyroid have a positive for antiparietal cell antibodies, and it may be a lack of B12 absorption causing fatigue in many of those cases due to antiparietal cell antibodies, and that may also be impeding stomach acid production, which may be impacting absorption of minerals, which can then contribute to further worsening of thyroid issues. So consider a multi-mineral with stomach acid like Minrex by Zymogen as well in the case with thyroid issues like Hashimoto's. And consider antiparietal cell antibody testing and treatment with high-dose B12 injection therapy if that is an issue. So those are all considerations, and then looking at the gut and doing a lot of the other things. So hopefully this gives you some place to start with this woman with estrogen dominance, breast cysts, no cancer diagnosis. These are some of the things that we're going to look at in her case. Also consider, you know, many of those other exposures, toxin exposure, things we went over, electromagnetic frequency exposure, things we went over. So the last question that we have for today is we have a question about cannabis. And so some people talk about CBD, and CBD is something that gets a lot of attention today. And I want to talk a little bit about the research on CBD. Is almost primarily done in, almost completely done in animal models. There are not very many, if any, human clinical trials that I'm aware of. And a lot of the companies that are touting benefits from CBDs are referencing animal trials. And again, 92% of animal trials don't translate to humans. And the doses they're using in those trials are doses that would be for humans around 500 milligrams or more. And that's untenable to get that much in a CBD product. So CBD products you know, people are taking often 10, 15, 20 milligrams at a time. And there's no good research about that to believe that that's going to be helpful, even in animals. In animals, the benefit comes at doses that human equivalency would be many hundreds of milligrams, and that would be hundreds of dollars a day for people to do that treatment. So CBD, I think people, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that it works and people like it. So I'm okay with people using it, trying it out, seeing if it has a benefit for them. I do recommend a full spectrum extract and not an isolate if they're going to try it. And I think it's reasonable to try a liposomal form if they're going to try it. And again, it's not backed by research. The research that is there is really actually more on THC, which is, I know, is the psychoactive component. But THC does have some actual clinical trials backing several positive effects. And so I think THC is a worthwhile consideration for certain people for certain issues. There are benefits for a variety and host of conditions using THC at doses that people can easily have access to. In fact, the doses for THC are actually pretty low. 10 to 15 milligrams is typically a reasonable dose. Some people overdo it, go too high, and then it can have an opposite effect. For example, some of the effect for improving sexual arousal, which has been found a positive sexual arousal improvement. So for example, there was a study with women that were shown pornography without cannabis and did not have much arousal, and then had THC, IV THC that was, I think, a 10 or 15 milligram equivalent, and they were then shown porn and had a much higher arousal rate. So for sexual arousal, there is definitely some research showing some benefit. There's research showing some benefit for cancer in relation to some of the nausea and side effects from chemo and radiation. And one thing actually that I didn't mention on cancer that I really do want to get to is fasting. So fasting, if someone is not underweight, is extremely helpful, especially around time of chemo. If someone, when they're getting chemo, can fast all day that day, that's extremely helpful. 5-day fasting mimicking diet or fasting like diet can be helpful, although they want to change what they're eating each time, especially if it's around chemo, because chemo can make eating those same foods get associated with that toxic effect and cause a recurrence of symptoms later. So you want to vary or modify what people are taking when they're doing chemo and avoid supplements around chemo time, because you don't want them to create a bad reaction to the supplements, but fasting can be great. So intermittent fasting, fasting like diet, fasting mimicking diet, 5-day fasts or liquid fasts or low calorie fasts can be really helpful. So please keep that in mind as well. Additional points on cannabis are so some of the pain impacts. Now, again, the 10 to 15 milligrams THC can have an impact there. Headaches and migraines, it doesn't tend to change them, but people typically have less annoyance with them. In other words, they can tolerate them better. So 10 to 15 milligrams THC may be helpful for that as well. And there may be some there's definite benefit for seizures and neurological conditions. And you have to play with dose on that. So that's another use. And then there's sleep, insomnia. So it can be really, really good for insomnia. And typically for insomnia, a form that's going to last a little longer is better. So a tincture is a nice form for that. So I recommend often tinctures for insomnia. And then and starting low, working your way up slowly is often a good practice with cannabis. So that's just a brief overview of cannabis. Just because we had that question, I wanted to give you guys a brief overview. If you have other specific questions, feel free to send them in. But I think there's a lot of hype about CBD, and I think it may pan out in human research, but the dose may be so high that it's not tenable to get that dose without prices coming down. And that's just a guess. We'll see how it translates. I'm totally open to people experimenting themselves and seeing how they feel and being a judge for themselves. If they want to, fine, sure, go ahead. But in terms of recommending things based on human trials and dosages that are in research, unfortunately, at this point, CBD does not have that backing. So I do hesitate to advise people on it and tend to prefer to advise people on THC, which is recreational in the state of Colorado. So we can have people just go get some recreational, or medical, both. So there's both options available. And of course, we want to advise people on the form and the quantity and the duration and the dosage and, addiction and dependency, and talk about all that stuff when we're advising people on that. But it can be really, really helpful and is a much better alternative to other sleeping medications and other medications for pain and certain other conditions. In fact, there's no medications for arousal. So that's a really nice one to help couples. Last thing I want to bring up is toxic relationships. That's going to be another, and the mental emotional piece, that's going to be another really important thing for cancer diagnosis. So please do have that conversation, that dialogue with people. Make sure that they ask their loved ones to treat them like a normal person, not like someone, not like a cancer diagnosis. Don't treat a person like a cancer diagnosis. Treat a person like a person. And have people do take some time to do some things that they want to do. If they're in a toxic job or a toxic relationship, maybe this is the permission they need to get out or to do the work to improve it. And so having that conversation with people about their relationships, their job, what they really want with their life, where they want to go, do they have a bucket list that they haven't gone down? Do they want to travel? Can they still do that? These are great opportunities to have this kind of conversation with people and help people to take a dive, to really move in a direction that's a positive direction. So please do have that conversation with people. Make sure to take note of things that might be helpful for them to make transformation in their life, and help them to talk to the people around them to treat them like a normal person still, and let them, really guide their relationships and choose relationships with people who are loving, caring, helpful people, but who aren't making too big a deal out of the diagnosis, so that it always is the front and center of conversations. Instead, we want to be dealing with people who are going to just, be able to be real and authentic and have a good connection and not always try and be overly caretaking. So that becomes a problem with cancer. So that's a wrap. I want to thank you for attending today, and I do believe that that's all the questions for today. So thank you so much, and I hope this has been really helpful. Please keep sending in the questions. They're much appreciated, and I've been enjoying getting these questions, and it does help us to give you the best information possible. So keep sending them in. Thank you so much for your time. We'll be posting a recording of this shortly. Have a healthy and happy and wonderful week, and I look forward to next time. Take good care.